the words. They have a lot of reminders of the things that we need to remember each day. There are songs of praise. There are songs glorifying God, and those are wonderful. There are songs proclaiming our love for him, our service to him. And then there are songs that remind us of truths that are key to life. And that song is one of those. And I appreciate its message. This morning, I want to talk about something that interestingly coincides with something that Dan Fite mentioned in a devotional last night. A lot of us here this morning are involved in the Broadway camp that began 2 days ago on Friday and it finishes this Saturday evening. It's over on the campus of Florida College. And it finishes, a lot of people here this morning are involved in that. Some are already members here and others who are visiting and are here because of the camp. It's great to see everyone here. We have several families away from us this morning who are sick, multiple families who are sick, and others who are traveling. But some of those numbers are replaced by our visitors. It's good to have you here. I'm going to start this morning talking about what we have, maybe just call it the long day of Joshua. It's a story many of us are familiar with, and I'm not connected. Hang on. Man, so I'm very happy this does not happen, but I did disconnect my thing, I'm afraid. While I was talking to someone, I was distracted. But anyway, we're going to talk about the long day of Joshua, what we call the long day. Wait for it. And there it is. Okay. It's a story that we don't understand everything, all the mechanics of the miracle, but it's a famous miracle nonetheless. Let's go back just to get that story briefly. It goes back to the time of Joshua. Moses has died, and Israel, the tribes, are conquering some of the Canaanites in the land of Canaan with Joshua as the general. And the story of Jericho, and the walls fall down, we know that story. And there's another story after that, the city of Ai, or Ai, as you would pronounce it, a very small military base or settlements that falls in dramatic fashion with fire going up into heaven, or toward into the sky, into the heavens. And after that, a nearby city called Gibeon, just a few miles away from Ai, or Ai, they see the smoke rising from the destruction, and they think, we've got to do something. And so they form a plan, and they dress some people up in old clothes, old shoes, get some old bread, and have them go to the Israelite camp down in Jericho. The Israelites are camped down in the valley near what used to be Jericho at this point. And Ai is up in the hills, in the mountains, and that's where Gibeon also is, up in the mountains. And we're probably next. We're a big city. We're important. We're right along the main highway that goes north and south in Canaan, and the Israelites are going to want to control that like any invading force would. So we're probably the next target. And so they have these people go down there in disguise. They'll come wandering into the camp tired. Hey, are you Israel? We're from very far away. And we've heard of you. We've heard of your God. We want to make a treaty with you, a pact. And how far away are we, do you ask? Oh, and it's very far away. You may not have heard of it. But see this bread, this old bread, it was fresh when we left, and now it's old. And our shoes were brand new, our clothes were new, and now they're old. We've traveled great distance. And Israel says, okay, and they make a deal, and a peace treaty, you know, non-aggression. Israel will not attack them. And the Gideon people are like, thank you, we'll begin our long journey back home. And the Israel apparently follows them a distance and realizes, hey, wait a minute, they're just up there in the mountains, just a few hours away. They tricked us, let's destroy them. And Joshua's like, no, we can't. We made a vow to not destroy them. And you know, God said, we can't do that. So we have to live in peace with them. And as they came up there, and Israel said, why did you all deceive us? And Gideon's like, hello, we want to live. And so Israel says, okay, we made a deal. We won't attack your city, but you have to be our servants. And Gibeon, the people there say, we can live with that. And so we'll be your servants. And now we come to our story. Gibeon has made a deal. And then, so they have peace. But Gibeon is not the only city in Canaan that has been watching Israel destroy Jericho and destroy Ai. There are other cities. And Gibeon has now made peace. They're not going to be destroyed. But who will be next? Well, there are five kings of other cities in the region, including Jerusalem at this point, and they realize we've got to do something. And we've got to do something to Gibeon. They made a deal. And now Israel has a friend on the main highway near our cities. They have a military base or an operating base. They can supply. They can have safe refuge. We've got to take this out. We've got to counterattack. And so five kings from five different cities of the Amorites gather their forces and went up against Gibeon. And there's Jerusalem and Hebron and Jarmuth and Lachish and Eglon. These five Canaanite cities decide, let's take out Gibeon, push back. We'll destroy this new friendly city for the Israelites, and we'll send a message to the other cities. Don't make friends with Israel. You're either with us or you're against us. So they all go to Gibeon right there and surround it to take out Gibeon. And here is Gibeon. That hill, Gibeon was on that hill. And we're looking at, looking north. So this is the same as on the map. You know, to the right is east and to the left is west. And so the Canaanites are surrounding this hill and Gibeon's on top there looking over their walls thinking, okay, we've got to do something again. And so they send messengers. Hey, Israel's our friend. And so they send messengers down to the right, go down into the Jordan River Valley and tell Israel, help us, help us. The other Canaanites are attacking. And Israel says, really? But wait, this could be an opportunity because those Canaanites attacking Gibeon, they're people we want to conquer anyway. They've left their city defenses. They're out in the open now in front of Gibeon. Okay, we'll help you out. And so what happens? Here's the story. The men of Gibeon, they said to Joshua, come help us. So Joshua, down there to the right in the valley, went up. They marched up through the night, about 8 hours probably, to march up to Gibeon. And the Lord threw them into a panic, the Canaanites, before Israel, who struck them with a great blow at Gibeon and chased them and struck them as far as Azekah and Makeda. There's Azekah, there's Makeda. So they chased them around and scattered them, and they pursue them all the way to these other cities. So on our picture here, Israel comes in from the right and surprises the Canaanites, attacks them, and they go fleeing that way to the left. This is where that happened. And so we look at our map, and they come in. Israel comes up from the right, and the Canaanites flee to the left and go down to these other places, a complete victory. Joshua destroys these Canaanite armies out in the field and away from their city defenses. Now their main armies are destroyed, and their cities don't have many soldiers left to protect the walls and the gates. Israel's not going to have an easier time taking the cities. That's a win-win, isn't it? But what I want to focus on here is something else. As Israel is chasing the Canaanites that way through the valley, it's getting late in the day and the sun is going down. And when it gets dark, you can't see the Canaanites anymore. And you want to destroy their armies before they get back to their city walls and protection. So Joshua does something. In chapter 10 of his book, verse 12 starting, Joshua spoke to the Lord and he said in the sight of Israel, Sun! Stand still at Gibeon. Moon in the valley of Ajalon. The sun stood still. The moon stopped until the nation took vengeance on their enemies. The sun stopped in the midst of the heaven and did not hurry to set for about a whole day. There's been no day like it before or since when the Lord heeded the voice of a man. The Lord fought for Israel. Notice that the last sentence is there. The focus is not really, there's been no day like before or since. It doesn't say there's been no day when the sun and moon stopped moving in the sky. That's not what it says. There's been no day like it when the Lord listened to the voice of a man in this kind of way. What did Joshua ask God, basically? Please stop time for a little bit. So the light will stay and we can destroy the rest of these armies before they get back to safety. And the Lord said yes. And he has never said yes in that way before or since. That's what the text points out. I mean, it's a miracle. That's, you know, an amazing thing. And that the mechanics of that, I don't know how he did it, because we know that the whole universe is motion effect. So however he did it, only he knows. But the Lord has not listened in that kind of way to a man before or since. And the Lord heeded the voice of Joshua. Unique, even amongst some of the miracles we have in the Bible. Quite a thing. And so we know where it happened. They were, the Valley of Ajalon is where you go when you're going to the left. And it's over this whole area there. When you fly into Israel today and drive to Jerusalem, the simplest route goes through the same valley where the sun and moon stood still. Right there. And there it is. This was the battlefield when the sun and moon stood still in this area. So it's a real place. It's not just some legendary myth, or it's a real place that we're talking about here. Well, Joshua asked for a very big thing. Have you and I ever asked for that kind of a, that level of a thing? Please stop the sun and the moon. Probably not. If he has, I'm not aware of him saying yes. But people don't normally do that, do they? Is that the kind of thing we would typically pray for? Lord, please stop the motion of the entire universe for something I want. When we put it that way, it doesn't sound like a very good prayer, does it? And yet Joshua basically did that. He asked for a very big thing. He prayed a lot, but he never prayed, as we know of, for something like this. And he never did it again that we know of. Did he ask too much? Is it possible to pray a bad prayer? An arrogant prayer, perhaps, or a selfish prayer? Yeah, selfish one. And we can probably think of ways we can be very selfish with our prayers. You know, sometimes, you know, like, you know, on sports teams, you know, whether, you know, even grown-ups or high school or even kids, sometimes people may pray, let us win the game. You know, or give us victory, Lord. Of course, what are we also asking for? Let them lose, Lord. You know, maybe, and sometimes it may be a little bit selfish. We're not praying for a good thing for us. We're praying also for a bad thing for someone else. It's possible to say a selfish prayer, one that affects other people negatively for my own benefit. That's not very, you know, well considered, is it? But is it possible to ask, did Joshua ask too much of God? We want to destroy our enemies and not let them get away. Please, Lord, sun and moon, stop. But the Lord apparently did not consider it bad, did he? How did the Lord answer? He answered with a yes. And afterwards, Joshua did not, as far as we know, say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. He didn't. The whole thing was considered a blessing. Joshua did not ask forgiveness. He didn't have a conscience problem with his prayer later. He went big, and God granted his petition. And we're told about this story, not the emphasis at the end is not on the amazing sun and moon thing. It says there's not been a day before or since when God listened to this kind of request and did it. So why are we being told this? What's the lesson for us? Let's make sure we have the lesson in context, but you know, what kinds of things do we ask for? Sometimes as believers, we believe God can do and does do amazing things. We know, we believe he rose, you know, he raised Jesus from the dead and other stories in the Bible. And yet, sometimes we show little faith in the things we ask of God or trust that he can do. Several times, the Lord even tells people, you don't have enough faith. Look at that, for example, Matthew 6. He's talking about people who are stressed and anxious about having what they need, and worry about that before they worry about the kingdom of God. And what is his message? He says, put the kingdom of God first. He says, if God clothes the grass, and which is, you know, just so temporary and not as valuable as you, won't he much more clothe you, you of little faith? Don't be anxious. Jesus had a reprimand for people who would, for the people of God, for not having enough faith that God really would fulfill his promises. Their faith is insufficient enough that they put other things in front of his kingdom. And then there are genuine things to think about, food and clothing and necessities of life. And Jesus says, put the kingdom first before these things. Don't you have faith? If the kingdom is not first in front of these other things, oh, people of little faith. This is not the only time the Lord describes people as having insufficient faith, too little faith. Now, there's another story later in Matthew 8. They're on a boat on the Sea of Galilee, his disciples, his closest disciples. And there's a storm, and they wake Jesus up. And they say, we're going to die. And Jesus tells them, oh, you're right. Hey, thank you for waking me up. Let me stop this storm really quickly.
No, be still.
That's not what I'm doing. He said, why are you afraid, people of little faith? Jesus was asleep. He wasn't worried about it. The storm didn't even wake him up. And the disciples, you know, wake up, wake up. And he says, why didn't you have enough faith? Did you think the Lord wasn't going to take care of you? And maybe some of that was because Jesus was on the boat. Do you think he's going to let me die now? No, maybe that was part of it. But he says, why are you afraid? That's not what he specifies. It's their fear. You have little faith. And, there's this story here. Every time Peter gets out of the boat, Jesus is walking on the water. Another time on the Sea of Galilee, another storm. And the disciples are afraid. And Jesus comes, you know, walking up. And Peter says, I want to go too. And Jesus says, come on. And Jesus says, come on. And Peter gets out of the boat. And he steps in the water. And he's walking on the surface. So that would probably boost my confidence. You know, okay, this is working. I can do this. But it has the opposite effect on Peter. And maybe it probably wouldn't be too, because it's not, you know, like, you know, still smooth water. The waves and the wind in Galilee can have some big storms, even today. But Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, came to Jesus. It's like several steps, apparently. But then the fear takes over. He saw the wind. He became afraid, and he began to sink in the water. Lord, save me. And Jesus took hold, pulled him, and said, what's he say? That's okay. You took several steps. That's a good start, Peter. He says, Peter, little faith, why did you doubt? See, multiple times, believers in God, it's noted that, yeah, you have faith, but your faith wasn't enough. Why didn't you have more faith? Why was your faith limited? We don't see him ever saying the opposite. And look at this. That time in Matthew 16, they're talking about a problem with food. They begin discussing it. The disciples said, we don't have any bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said, oh, you have little faith. Don't you remember the five loaves for the 5,000? You see, multiple times Jesus tells people, the Lord tells people, you didn't have enough faith. But we read the Bible, not once do we see Jesus say, hey, that's a little too much faith there. He doesn't do it. Several times, why didn't you have more faith? That's too little faith. But we never see him saying, whoa, 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 whoa. Not so much faith now. It doesn't happen. And that's an important observation. Look at this story in Matthew 17. Some disciples of Jesus, they believe in Jesus. They try to cast out a demon. And they can't do it. And so Jesus comes and does it immediately. And they come to Jesus afterwards. Why couldn't we do it? And Jesus' explanation, because of your little faith. Didn't have enough. He said, truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, tiny, tiny, tiny dot of a seed. If you have faith like that, you can say to a mountain, move, and it'll move. Nothing will be impossible for you. This is a metaphor, because we never actually see them literally moving a physical mountain. It's a metaphor, but a very good one. Mountain, what's the deal with a mountain? It's something that's not movable. You don't move a mountain. And he's speaking metaphorically here, saying there are obstacles in your path that may seem impossible, But they won't be if you ask in faith. There's a lesson. Do we ask big things of God? Are we afraid to ask big things of God? Like Joshua did. Jesus always praised great faith. At one time, a woman reaches out and just, asking for healing from a Gentile woman. And he says, I didn't come here, for Gentiles. And she says, no, you can do it. And he finally says, oh, woman, great is your faith. A little too great for my taste. No. Great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you desire. And her daughter is healed immediately. Jesus praised great faith. And there's another example. There's a centurion, another Gentile, not a Jew, a Gentile, a soldier in the Roman army, the occupying army in Judea and Galilee. In Luke chapter 7, a centurion had a servant who was sick at the point of death, and the centurion sent some friends, saying, Lord, don't trouble yourself to come to my house. I'm not worthy of that. This is a military officer for the other side, whose job is to control these Jews. But this centurion holds Jesus up higher than himself. Very unusual. But he says, the message sent through friends is, don't even bother coming. I'm not worthy for you to come into my home. Just say the word from a distance. My servant will be healed. And Jesus said, well, you're a Gentile. I'm a little offended. It doesn't say that. Of course you're worthy of me. No. Jesus heard these words. He marveled. Turning to the crowd of Jews that followed him, he said, not even in Israel have I found this kind of faith. Jesus always praised great demonstrations of faith from simple requests, even. And when the people who had been sent came back to the centurion, the servant was already healed. How much faith do I show in my prayers? Let's take a moment to review, what things have I asked God for in the past week? Thinking, what have I asked God for? What kinds of things? And maybe some of it is we're asking for wisdom. We're told to do that. Of course, be careful what you ask for. How do we get wisdom usually? The Lord doesn't just open our heads and pour it in there. Often, he gives us the experiences that produce wisdom. And we hope that's easier than that sometimes. It's not always easier, but maybe we ask for wisdom, and that can be a big thing. We're asking for the experiences that produce it. Have you prayed for patience recently? And again, how do we get patience? Lord, please give me patience. And please just let it come naturally, with no trials in my heart. Experience tells us that's not the way we get patience. We get patience by the trials and experiences that challenge us and force us to choose patience. That's usually the way it comes. So maybe those simple things are actually bigger things than we sometimes think about anyway. But what's the biggest thing I prayed for? Maybe for someone who's sick to get better. Maybe for someone who has some serious illness like cancer or something that is deadly to be better. Maybe should I even pray for that? Maybe we do. That's a big thing. And it is big. What's the biggest thing I've prayed for recently? All of us can answer for ourselves, to ourselves. But how much faith is reflected in the things I pray about? Is it possible that I'm among many people in the Bible whom the Lord might say, you're not showing enough faith. You're showing too little. The Lord never reprimanded someone for showing too much faith. Maybe selfish prayers or self-serving prayers. There are words about those in the Bible. But there's not an example we have where he says, you just ask too much and I'm disappointed. Do I have the faith to pray for big things, however I would define them? Do I limit my prayers? Do I find myself sometimes saying, I should pray, oh, maybe I shouldn't pray for that. That's sort of pointless. Maybe it's too big of a thing to ask. Do I do that? Maybe I have done that. Do I pray like Joshua? Something big, maybe it's a mountain, it's not possible, but I ask anyway. Joshua was not criticized. Even though The text says there's never been a day before or after either when the Lord said yes to something like that. The Lord doesn't always say yes. Joshua was an exception. The text tells us Joshua was an exception. No one before or since that the Lord listened to it that way. But there are other big ways the Lord listens to us, and maybe he will respond with a yes. Jesus promised responses to big prayers if we have genuine faith, even if we really believe that it feels like a little bit of faith. Do I pray like Joshua? When we pray with great faith, however that would be defined, mustard seed size or bigger, maybe some questions we should ask. Is, am I seeking his glory? Lord, I'm going to pray a big prayer. I want to be so well known and have, you know, famous enough for whatever I do for a living, and lots of money so I have financial security for my family. I'd like to be a millionaire so I can protect my family. Yes, that sounds like a good purpose. Is that the only reason I'm asking to be a millionaire? Yeah. Am I doing it for God's glory? What was a part of Joshua's motivation? Why did Joshua want to have the sun and moon stand still? Well, he's a general. He wants to win the battle, and he's thinking ahead to other battles. If he can destroy the armies here, maybe there won't be as many future battles, and that can save lives. Maybe that's probably a part of it. But also, we see many times, like Moses and Joshua, when something goes badly, like the first battle of Ai, one of the problems Joshua has after that loss is that, Lord, what are people going to think of you? You brought your people out of Egypt. You brought them through the wilderness. And now we come here only to lose the reputation of our God, of you. What happens to your reputation? People like Joshua had those considerations in their hearts. When I'm praying big, what are my reasons for going big? Is it self-serving? Is it selfish? Does it also ask for maybe harm on someone else? Am I genuinely seeking the kingdom, God's kingdom, through my prayers? What does James write? He's writing to Christians. And he says one problem that they're having in chapter 4, you don't have because you don't ask. Talking about prayer. You ask but don't receive, though. Why? Because you ask wrongly, to spend it on your passions, selfish prayers, to benefit my own life in some way that I want. It's not about the kingdom. It's not about others. And some part of my request, it's about me. And James says, you ask but you don't have because it's selfish. You're looking for something self-serving. And that's important to remember. Now, we ask big, but be sure that we're asking in faith and also not for selfish reasons related to our own desires, our own passions. What does Paul write in 1 Corinthians 9? We must do all things for the sake of the gospel, including pray. Do I pray big for the sake of the gospel? For the sake of the kingdom. And another thing to remember is that God doesn't always respond immediately. He responds, as a song says that we sing frequently, in his time. And one of the great reasons that song is popular and it's a favorite for so many of us is the reminder. It's a theological statement. God answers every prayer in his time, not in my time. My time reflects my desires, my passions, my wants. But in his time, the Bible is full of examples of people who pray, and God responds in his time. Abraham, God, maybe he'd prayed many times for a child, and God tells him, I'm going to give you a son, and in fact, you'll have nations come from you, so many descendants like the sand, like the stars. How many years did Abraham wait for that promise to be answered? About 25. And 25 years to you and me is a long time. In God's time, in his time, it's not long, but that's sometimes what happens. We must do all things for the sake of the kingdom. And we talk about asking for patience. Sometimes his answer, if it's a yes, may be a long time in coming. And we must be humble enough and prepared to wait on the Lord in his time. May you and I, all of us, be willing to pray big, to have a prayer that reflects big faith, full trust. God can do these, and this is something I'll ask for it, because I know God can do it if it's in his will. May we all have the faith to pray on that level, like Joshua did. And may we also have the patience and the wisdom of people like Abraham to wait upon the Lord, wait in his time, and be humble, trusting that someday he will answer yes, but especially that he will answer our prayers for salvation, for deliverance from this life and its trials and its hardships and its weakness. Thank you for your kind attention. And may we all benefit from the example of Joshua and so many others.
Before the Lord's Supper, we'll sing number 12 in the blue song, number 12. We'll sing the first, second, and fifth verse of the song. We'll also sing it as it's arranged here with the refrain.